Hello and welcome to the show. I'm Martin Willis, your host, and we have Alejandro Rojas coming up with the news in just a minute. I want to thank everyone that supports the show, and for just $2 or more a month, you can help us out. And all that information is on podcastufo.com. And if you can't do that and you still want to listen to the full shows, you can watch it on YouTube every Wednesday or on podcastufo.com every Wednesday at 8 p.m. to 10 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, or on the Dark Matter Digital Network. And that's at 10 to midnight p.m. Eastern Standard Time. And again, thanks everyone that helps us out. Our guest this evening is Linda Zimmerman. Linda's been on a number of times. She's going to be talking first. We're going to be talking about the Pentagon UFO and what that has changed in her life as far as that story coming out. And then we're going to be talking about ghosts and hauntings and all of her investigations. As I had mentioned before a number of times, once in a while I'm going to put in a different type of show, and that is tonight. And I'm really excited about having Linda on. She's always, always great. And that's it for me. Alejandro, how are you?
I'm good. How are you?
Good.
Hello.
Good. Hello.
Hello, YouTube.
Yeah, that's right. Oh, by the way, Evan is our show producer, and I think things are going to be going a lot smoother now. It just seems like it's so much nicer to have some help. I really feel relieved.
I can't believe you tackled all of that, doing all the technical switching and everything. And I know the program you use. I've been playing with it to use myself to speak about stuff and to try to see and share insight all at the same time. I don't know how you did it.
Yeah. Well, the one thing I can never stop is when the internet goes out, and occasionally that happens. Just can't stop that, you know. Robert Powell and mine went out at the same time. That was just really crazy. And, of course, it was the government. We know it's the government that did that. Who else, right?
Mm-hmm. Mm. Yeah, anyway, we better be careful.
I know. Better watch my P's and Q's. So what's going on in the UFO world?
Well, UFO stuff, there is some news out there. I don't know. I don't think anything really huge. I mean, there's of course, the UK tabloids are always making a big deal about some really wild and sometimes goofball-y kind of stuff. So there's always something in those silly UK tabloids. And it kills me because, of course, sometimes they interview some of us and they have some decent stuff. But I feel that that is far and few between. So, and I always acknowledge it because I know people are seeing it because now they're doing stories every day. Sometimes stealing stories, like they stole the Sun story about an interview with me, and that just blatantly one of the other ones just takes it, summarizes, and doesn't give credit. So there's that out there. Again, wow. Take that with a grain of salt, I guess, is all I'm warning people. But otherwise, what's cool is mainstream media, I think, is taking note of this topic much more. So, for instance, Brooklyn talking about being out there near New York, not too far from where Linda is at right now, a lot closer than I am, that's for sure, and closer than you are. Brooklyn, there's a story in their paper about UFO sightings out there, so that's pretty cool. Also, an article about UFOs skyrocketing in, at least the number of sightings skyrocketing in Italy. So that's kind of interesting, And that's made from some news that's gone on out there. And this is kind of cool, too. And the TC Palm, it's a Florida local paper. There's a guy, you know, some businessman in the area who decided he wanted to write about how UFOs need to be taken more seriously. And this DOD thing kind of shows that. So really interesting. Newsweek has an article. They're kind of debunking some of the stuff people see on Mars. But, you know, Yeah, that's okay, because there is some silly stuff regarding that. But still, I think there's a lot more, and you and Linda, I know, are going to talk about there a lot more, I think, coverage and mainstream coverage of this topic and serious coverage than there were previous. I think, you know, if a local guy decides to write an opinion piece on how we need to pay attention to UFOs, I think prior to December, people even would have scoffed more than they are now. Now, you know, I think people like him feel more emboldened to come out and say, hey, You know, I've believed in this stuff for years, and I'm tired of hiding it. And now I'm going to tell everybody that I agree. This is a significant mystery out there.
Right. Well, let's talk about. You had a great interview. I listened to it today with Leslie Kane. Just fantastic. And so I think I'm actually going to put a link to that in the show notes here.
So, okay.
I just thought it was just so well done, and a lot of stuff came out. I mean, I was so interested in some of the things she said.
You know, we've all been dying to ask questions about the background and what happened, how and why, what does she know about the program and this and that, and we're all looking for those answers. So luckily, hopefully, a week from today, I'll be interviewing Luis and ask Elizondo, of course, the guy who ran the program. So we'll get a lot more answers then. But we still got some great answers. Like for me, what was really interesting is how the story came about to be in the first place. And, you know, with all of these conspiracy theories that run rampant, people assuming, well, it's obvious how this came about. The smoking man, you know, showed up in the garage and told her to do this. And that discounts the work that people do. So what really happened, you know, is that she, you know, you've interviewed her and I did after October when the To the Stars announced that they started their organization, and she identified this is really important. So she went to a colleague who writes for the New York Times, who's friendly on this topic, Ralph Blumenthal, and he said, "You're right, this is a big deal, let's do this." So he you know, championed it. They went to the New York Times, and they talked the New York Times into it, and essentially the New York Times says, "We'll do it. But, you know, we got to do it the right way." And so they did a lot of hard work, a lot of research. They did interviews with important people, with Louise, of course. And then they released their article, which was well researched. And that obviously had a huge impact. And I think that's really important that people understand how this works, because when people just, you know, throw out, oh, it's obvious that the media is under control and they only do what people tell them to do. I work in the media. Lee Spiegel, who of course we work with a lot, works in the media. I think Linda works in the media. Leslie, of course, does, and George Knapp and Bryce Zabel, who's going to be speaking at the conference, and so many people. We can go on and on. That's what they do, you know, and you can ask those people how it actually works. And all of these people come up with their own stories. They're not told what stories to come up with. What's difficult is people are like, well, why don't they print this or that? Well, there's a high bar when it comes to credibility, and you've got to reach that bar. You've got to have credible sources for your information, and it'll be taken seriously. And unfortunately, people, when you throw out speculation and you know, all of these things, you have to substantiate what you say. And Leslie does that. And that's why her stories do very, very well. And, you know, and they're all so important for raising the credibility for this field in general. So, it was great to hear the details about how that all came about.
Yeah. And one of the things that I really liked, you know, thought was very interesting is she said it was so much work. She said every single paragraph, we had to have, you know, the backup. We had to have, you know, I mean, they had to edit. They had to, you know, the New York Times wanted to make sure everything was just perfect before that was, you know, released.
Yeah, that was a great point, because she says, you know, I can post what I want in the Huffington Post. Nobody says anything. And that's the same for me. Of course, if someone complains or they find out that we've been inaccurate or we're being goofy, then we'll get yanked and we'll never be able to do it again. So we have to be careful in that way. But it's different when you're working with some of these other outlets like the New York Times, where they have to fact check every single line. So it's a lot of work. They've got to substantiate every single thing that they're saying. And it's especially important in these days. People don't realize that. They talk about fake news and all of this other stuff, but they don't realize the hard work that is going on in the background to verify some of this. Because remember, the media, their critics are not just the public or whoever they're writing about, be it politicians on either side or whatever, but each other. They check each other. It's a cutthroat field where, you know,
absolutely,
if New York Times screws something up, then that's going to be a news story and people will be going to be all over them.
That's right.
So
it's just like I check out your podcast to make sure you don't make any mistakes.
To call me out.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
Oh, that alien that you had on there was not from Zeta Reticuli. That one's from Venus.
That's right. Can't you tell, for God's sake?
Yeah.
No, another thing that, you know, she makes a really good point on is that there's no scent of any type of government manipulation or cover-up in this thing, which I think is really important because there's so much out there. People are saying so many things along those lines.
I thought what was really interesting is when I asked her if they ran the story by the DOD at all, she was taken aback. She's like, no, you know, and I know I've known Leslie for a long time, and I can tell she was like, what a ridiculous question. She didn't like that question. But and I think she thought I was being kind of goofy. But in my defense, you know, Nick Pope said he did run his book by the Ministry of Defense, his last Rendlesham. And Charles Holt has ran his stuff by, because they're just trying to be careful. They are still under their oaths. They're still patriots. They don't want to step over boundaries or say anything that they shouldn't. So I don't think it would have necessarily. And speaking with Louise, he's very careful with that, too. He doesn't want to compromise, you know, any information, and he doesn't want to share anything he shouldn't either. And that's where I thought maybe he wanted to be careful and have his colleagues look at the story before it was released. But it sounds like they didn't do that. However, in speaking with Louise, I know that he is careful about that, and he does. But at the same time, you know, so we needed to know what level of government involvement there was. And it sounds like there was zero, except for the quotes that they got from the DOD and, of course, Louise's cooperation. But he's now no longer with the government. So, yeah, there's some insight for people, further indication that there was no manipulation or even influence on the story, which I think you can tell from reading it because it's much more transparent. There's more information that we got from that story than we normally would from a government story or agency. But Louise, you know, people haven't heard from him much yet either on a lot of these topics. And so I can see maybe why they may be a bit skeptical there as well. And I'm lucky as where I've had a little bit more conversations. And fortunately, we're going to be sharing a lot more with people, and I know he's going to be coming out more, and people are going to get to know him better, and I think that will alleviate a lot of people's concerns. A lot of people who want to think of him as some evil, you know, or manipulator who's only releasing information in a manner which he's instructed to do so, those people, some of them, I think, will also be disappointed because, unfortunately, that perspective of theirs, I think, will begin to crumble as they meet him. Some people right. are steadfast to that, but some people aren't. Some people are good people, and I've even seen this where people are making these sorts of accusations, and he says, hey, I've seen some interactions where he said, no, this is what I'm really about. This is why I've done it. And then people are like, okay, you know, I can understand that. And it's all about just going out there, asking questions and understanding that the machinations behind what motivates people and everything before you make, you know, assumptions and steadfast, you know, opinions. You got to go discover and get the information. And that's fun. I mean, researching, investigating is fun. So, you know, I think Linda is a perfect example, your guest tonight. She goes out there and does some research. She wrote a story about dogs and UFO encounters us not too long ago. So fascinating, you know, bringing to light a lot of information that people don't have, and doing that research is fun and getting the truth out there. The truth is also often stranger than fiction. And so, you know, it's fun to get the real answers instead of just making assumptions. That's not as fun to me.
So just a couple of things. First of all, your interview with Luis Elizondo, is that going to be one that you're doing for the conference, or is that going to be a podcast?
No, that's for the conference. Maybe hopefully up. You know, in a month. So we'll probably put like bits and pieces of that out. But of course, as normal with the lectures, you know, you can go online and watch them on video on demand. You can see Linda's presentations at the UFO Congress at Video On Demand, or you can purchase the DVDs at the store. We'll have pieces of it out, and we'll certainly write stories about some of the more important things that he says. But I think over time, we'll hear him on podcasts and everything. I think they're just being careful about this initial release of information with the New York Times. But as time goes on and he begins to interact with people in the field more, we'll all hear more from him.
Yeah, I had Ralph Blumenthal on way back a couple of years ago, and he actually, we've been in communication. Hopefully he's going to come on within a few months, but he said he has some more reporting to do. But real quickly, cool. about your conference, the International UFO Congress coming up in February, it starts February 14th or 15th?
14th.
So it starts on Valentine's Day. Now, I'm going to be there, and I'm going to be broadcasting just to let anyone know. If you're listening and you're going to be there, I hope you join us. And look me up. I'd love to meet anyone that's that listens to the show there. So that's going to be on Valentine's Day, and it's going to be at 6 p.m. local time, Phoenix time, 4 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. We're going to be doing
what
that
your show is.
Oh yeah.
Well, you've got to ask for a break or the time off because you're an employee for the conference. So
that's right.
Put in your request, and we'll see if
writing,
we can fit that in.
Oh boy. Yeah. Okay. All right. I'll get that certified this week.
All right.
All right, Alejandro. Thanks so much. And
Thank you.
All right. We'll be talking to you next week.
All right. Talk to you soon.
All right. Bye. Okay. So our guest is we have Linda Zimmerman. Now, she is a former research scientist, and she began paranormal investigations over 20 years ago, and she is now an award-winning author. She has over 30 books. I couldn't believe I was looking through her books the other day. And a lot of them are on haunts, and we're going to be talking about her ghost investigations. And she's also been on TV a few times. We're going to be talking, at first, we're going to talk about UFOs, and then we'll get into the other stuff. Linda, welcome back to the show.
Thank you. Always a pleasure to be here.
Yes, you're always a great guest. I'm always enjoy having you on.
Thank you.
Yeah. So right off the bat, I would like to talk about what has happened since we were talking briefly ahead of time. What's happened in your world since the story broke on December 16th in the New York Times?
Well, it was amazing. I immediately was getting calls and emails and Facebook messages. You know, did you know that pilots were seeing things that they couldn't explain? And at first I'm like, well, what are we talking, the 40s, the 50s, you know, which decade? Because to us, this is not new news. But so many people, they finally listened. They finally heard what was being said, and it really affected them. And people who didn't have really any previous interest, suddenly they wanted to know. And I've been getting, I've had a big uptick in people sending me their UFO stories from anywhere from last year to the 1970s. It's kind of opened the floodgates, and this is just, it's a wonderful time to be a UFO researcher.
Absolutely. And so where do you think, it's interesting how, I don't know if you've noticed this, but people that have not really paid attention to UFOs are actually talking about them.
Exactly. I got an email from one friend who, you know, kind of would jokingly scoff at my interest in UFOs, and suddenly he's, you have to pay attention to this. And I said, yes, that's what I've been doing. It's like a whole generation of people have discovered UFOs. And it's really opened a lot of eyes, and I hope the information keeps coming out, because we can't, you know, the attention span of the average person is, you know, about 5 seconds.
That's right.
So yeah, we really need to keep up, everybody keep doing what they're doing and getting more and more information out there.
I agree 100%. And another thing is, we have to make sure the people that are looking for information get the right information.
And exactly.
It's very unfortunate that there's so much bogus information out there, that is going to quickly turn someone away. You know, I mean, once they get involved in something and find out it's a hoax or something like that, there's really no, we have no control over it. But all we can do is, you know, keep our side of the street clean, so to speak, and do what we can do.
Right, right. You know, I avoid the politics. I avoid, you know, the controversies. My goal, get the information, do the research, interview the people, and then spread the stories. Get that information out in a, you know, in just a clean, unbiased way. Here's the information. Let the people decide what to do with it. Don't embellish it. You don't need to embellish a UFO story.
I mean, that's right.
Right?
They're crazy enough.
Exactly. Exactly. Someone just emailed me yesterday. He said, I know you're going to think I sound as nutty as a Snickers bar. But he had his story to tell from, again, 1983, decades and decades ago. Yeah. But now he felt was the time to come out and tell someone.
I'm actually getting email as well from a number of people that are, you know, possibly the first time they've ever talked about it. I don't really know. But yeah, it's good times. I'm really glad that I've stuck to this long enough to see this this happen. And I think it's, you know, if it can be, like you just said, the attention span, everything's so ephemeral. It could just go so quickly, and with everything in the news now, especially politics. People are just like, wow, that's really something. And then next week, you know, they forget all about it.
Next day's news cycle, and it's all forgotten.
Yeah.
But there's a lot of points still in this story that I would like to see people really delve into. Like what caught my attention. I grew up during the Mercury, Gemini, Apollo, you know, missions. Oh, yeah. I was a space baby, and I love astronauts. I have a wall of astronaut photos. And when I heard that John Glenn was the one urging Harry Reid to look into this, that really caught my attention, because Glenn didn't really dip his toe into that subject during his career. He was, you know, he stood back. And to know that he had seen something or know people who had, I would love to know more of what he knew. And actually, I was reminded, I don't know if you ever used to watch the show Frasier.
Oh, yeah. Yep.
Yeah. In 2001, John Glenn was on Frasier, and it was kind of presented as a little spoof where he just started talking about all these UFO sightings and how he hated to cover up the truth. And, you know, they were telling him, you can't say what you saw, you know, and he felt bad about that. And, you know, they presented it as a, you know, as a comedy. But in retrospect, maybe he was telling the truth, you know?
How about that? I don't remember him on there. I didn't happen to see that particular one, but he was definitely a hero of mine when I was a child.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So when someone of the caliber of John Glenn, I don't know how the younger generations feel about astronauts, but they were our heroes.
They were.
I mean, they just did the most amazing things. And to me, there is no better caliber of person to observe a UFO than an astronaut or, you know, a test pilot or something like that. So I don't know if it's possible to find out more about what he knew or, you know, but I'm hoping to see more of that aspect of the story.
Yeah. So that makes that's about four astronauts, maybe even five. You know, I know the fourth man on the moon, I got to interview Alan Bean about his artwork on another show that I do. But when I asked him if you talk about the major UFO sighting he had, you know, that's well documented, he wouldn't talk about it. So I don't know how many astronauts actually talk about it.
There aren't too many. I actually give a lecture on astronaut UFO sightings,
wow.
Which is something I started years ago, and a lot more has come out. But I don't know what kind of agreements they signed, but I think it does a disservice to science to not talk about it, because these are the people we can trust, and if they have a legitimate sighting, people should know about it. So maybe this whole Pentagon UFO thing will start, you know, loosening that up as well, and having more people come forward in that field.
I can't believe I asked Seth Shostak. I said, well, what do you think about, you know, astronauts that have seen, you know, UFOs? What do you think about mm-hmm. that? And he said, that makes absolutely no difference. They're no better than anyone else. That was his, you know, and I totally disagree with that.
That's ridiculous. That, yeah. I lose all respect for somebody who says something like that. I mean, that's a strong statement, but how can you say that? They're so highly trained. They were the best of the best.
Yeah. They didn't get to be an astronaut by accident. You know, I mean,
no.
You know, splendid skills with everything, you know, math, you name it, everything.
Oh, yeah. You know, PhDs in engineering and test pilots and fighter pilots. Right. And how many hours did they spend in the air and in space? And their lives depend on every single observation they make every second. So to make that statement, that's... Come on, Seth.
you know, sometimes I think about this and I reflect on it. 1969, we were on the moon. I mean, and you think of what we had for computers, for equipment. Yeah. You know, I mean, they say a keychain fob had more, you know, computer in it than, you know, the space capsule. I mean, it's just amazing that we actually could accomplish that in such a short time. 20,000 people were involved in that. And that's something that, you know, these conspiracy theorists that say we never actually landed on the moon, you know, but there were 20,000 people working on that.
Right, right. Yeah, that I have no time for those people either.
I just have to tell you something really funny, because I had someone on the show a while back that said, no, you know, we never landed on the moon. And so I told him, I said, well, how about we can actually see the rovers and we can see the, you know, landing module and everything on the moon now. You know, there's photographs of them. And he said, oh, they put them up there afterwards. We didn't have the technology then. I love that one. That's my favorite.
Why let facts get in the way of a ridiculous story?
Yeah.
So, go ahead.
No. So getting back to the Pentagon UFO, I understand there's at least one more video. Now, I heard George Knapp early on say that, and I wish I could talk to Luis Elizondo himself, but supposedly George Knapp, I think he said there was 10 videos, but there's supposed to be at least one that's going to be coming out soon.
And I hope so. That was just amazing. To hear the pilots in their own voice, it's rotating. It's, you know, it just remarkable. So the more the merrier. Keep it coming, you know, in a steady stream, and things will have to change. Look what one did.
I know. It's amazing. I've actually, you know, I had Stan Friedman on a while back and a couple of weeks ago, and he said, this is a whole new ball game. And I totally agree.
He's right.
Yeah.
He's right. It is. But there were a couple of other points on that New York Times article that caught my attention. One of them, when it was talking about Bigelow modifying one of his buildings to hold material, supposedly, from, I don't know if it's crashed, I don't know if it actually specified, but just some sort of material. And I was like, modifying a building. Now, if it was radioactive, just build a radiation lab. But why would you need to modify a building?
Unless it was size.
Possibly. That's a good point. But it brought me back to the case I spoke about last time I was on your show about the in Connecticut in 1960, some metallic substances fell near Hartford and New Haven, and they did a chemical analysis on it, had extremely high levels of barium and strontium, which they couldn't understand why it was so high. But the thing was, the substance was losing weight, and it was causing material around it to lose weight as well.
Bizarre.
Now, that I can't understand. It said a large amount of material near this metallic substance was losing weight. Now, if this is something extraterrestrial and it causes things to lose weight, lose mass. You kind of don't want it near all of your lab equipment, and you know what I mean? So I just wanted to bring that up because, of course, this is not the first time they claim to have something. And the fact that they were modifying the building, you know, sort of put up some red flags for me saying, well, what kind of unique properties does it have that they are, you know, that they have to build something or modify something? It could be just a very huge object, or it could be doing something to normal terrestrial material that is highly unusual.
Now, I don't know if this is related at all, but I saw a real cryptic tweet from Tom DeLong. Someone actually sent it to me, mm-hmm. of like material chemical analysis or something. And I thought, wow, does this have anything to do with that? You know, I mean, but even so, you know, it's probably made up of elements that are all through the universe, whatever it is.
Right, but they can certainly tell, like when a meteorite is examined, they can tell by the composition and the gases where it's from, and this may just have things that are highly unusual. I don't know. I haven't gotten any more information on that. I would love to hear about chemical compositions or a little bit more. Do you know, are they planning on releasing any more on the substances?
All I know is that Bigelow is not really talking to anyone right now. He may change. I mean, he's got his hands full with the, you know, his space program. But,
right.
But I think he's purposely not talking to anyone right now about any of this. Linda, just one quick second. Would you mind lifting your mic up a little bit, like just up? I'll tell you when to stop.
How's
a little
that?
Further. A little further. Right there is perfect.
Okay.
All right. That's perfect. So, I would really be interested in that, you know, what happens with that. You mentioned there was something, a few things. Is there something else about that article as well?
Well, the other thing, you know, my special area of interest is the Hudson Valley, particularly the Hudson Valley wave of the 1980s. And I posted something for the 35th anniversary just a couple of weeks ago. And immediately people are saying, well, everyone knows they were secret government craft. Like, you know, what did you have a summer job at Skunk Works? How do you know this? And when Luis Elizondo, I think it was on CNN, said that the craft that was in the 2004 video, that is nothing in the U.S. inventory. We don't have things that can do that in the U.S. inventory. And I'm like, well, if we didn't have that in 2004, we sure as heck didn't have that in 1983 and 1984. So I think we have to now reevaluate all previous sightings if it's not U.S. government. How many sightings can you name? I mean, we could spend the rest of the night. How many sightings can we name that are explained away as secret government projects?
A lot of skeptics, that's where they'll turn the whole thing. You know, people are saying that it's probably something, you know, most likely military. I mean, I hear that over and over again. But one of the things they don't talk about is what you just said. The early sightings. I mean, they've seen things going 20,000 miles an hour in the late 60s.
Right.
You know, and that's not going to be something a government had. I mean, they couldn't hide something that long anyway. And that goes also over and over again for the triangle UFOs. That's what you hear all the time, that it's like the military. And it's possible the military has something that we don't know about. But there's a lot of questions that would have to be answered. One, why would something like that fly over a populated area? And someone wrote me last time I said that, and they said because they want to see the reaction to it. So I don't know. I mean, it's all speculation, but I certainly don't think that we had something like that, 40, 50 years ago. Absolutely not.
Yeah, so I think with his statement and with whatever more information's coming out, we now have to reevaluate the history of UFOs, and those skeptics are going to have to go back to their swamp gas theories.
Now, did you watch any of the interviews with people like, say, Neil deGrasse Tyson on this? Did you watch any of those interviews?
I did not. I did not see his. I heard some quotes.
Yeah.
But he seemed to at least think maybe it was a good idea that we look into this, although...
That's right. And one thing he did, and I hope that people caught this, I know Alejandro did, was that he said, who's saying it's aliens, and why would you go aliens, and all that, when there was never one word about aliens in that article.
No, there wasn't. There wasn't. And I saw another article and an interview with somebody from Astronomy Magazine in Boston, and he's saying, well, we just spent $110 million on this and, this. And I'm like, no, right off the bat, you're incorrect. It was $22 million over 5 years, not $22 million a year, and completely dismissive. And it's like, no, if you're going to be a skeptic about this and you're going to refute it, at least get your basic facts correct. And who was it? Michio Kaku said hypersonic drones, possibly. Is that correct?
He had a fairly positive attitude about it, though.
He did, but he still said, who knows, maybe it's hypersonic drones.
I think someone did send that to me, yeah.
Yeah, hypersonic drones that are enormous Tic Tacs. So, still, I don't pretend to know what the secret government projects are, but again, when somebody like Elizondo, who should know because he is assessing aerial threats, he should know what we have in our inventory. And if he said things that can hover, go really fast, no visible means of propulsion or wings, and so on, that we didn't have that in 2004, well, now let's go back and look at every sighting, that has a military excuse prior to 2004. And there's a lot of them, as you know.
The naval commander, David Fravor, he's been on a number of interviews. He was just interviewed by the Boston Globe. I think today it came out. But I love the details he's giving of this, that so-called Tic Tac, about it being, a few feet above the water and absolutely no, rotor wash or any means of propulsion, nothing, and it just zigging back and forth. It's really quite amazing that he actually saw that. I'm trying to get him on the show. I have not.
Oh, that would be wonderful.
I did get a connection. We'll see what happens. Yeah, that would be great. Yeah. And it's great that these people are actually talking about it. And one of the things he did say in the Boston Globe article today is people really need to take this seriously. And I love that more people are saying that.
Yeah, pilots are just wonderful. The details they come up with. They're some of my favorite witnesses.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, there's another great witness, our pilots. Mm-hmm. And unfortunately, I had this conversation the other day. The FAA just wants to turn their head when it comes to, commercial pilots. They don't want to know anything about what they see.
Way to kill your career is to just state what you saw. Right. And that's, again, that is doing a disservice to science and to people who've spent their whole careers, you know, dedicated to flying. If you don't respect them and you don't think they can understand what they're looking at, why are you putting them, you know, in the cockpit of a multi-million-dollar plane with a several hundred passengers?
Absolutely. So, Linda, before we move on to the hunting part of your research, mm-hmm. which I had no idea. I don't know how you and I got in that conversation to begin with. But before we go there, I would love for you to tell your UFO sighting story. I know you did it the last time you were on, but I'd just love to hear that story.
So okay,
if you would,
sure.
Share that with us, please.
Sure. It was December of 1979, and I was in college and sitting around in my red furry bathrobe and with my boyfriend and another friend, and someone else comes running in and saying there's three lights out there. So we go running outside, and it's three whitish yellow lights flying along in a kind of a V-shaped formation. And me being me, I jump in the car. Let's go. Let's follow them. So we follow them. It's a long story, but eventually we follow them to a state park, Harriman State Park, this Lake Tirati. And sitting there looking for them, because they had kind of disappeared for a little while, and then all of a sudden one comes from, I can just picture this, one comes from the east, one comes from the north, one comes from the south, and they're all converging right by this lake where we're sitting in the car. And we're like, oh my God, they're going to crash. They're going to explode. They come together in a bright flash of light. And then as one object, I don't know how this happened, these three objects became one. Wow. Lower onto the mountaintop, right just a few hundred feet away from us, and there's this pulsating glow at the top of the mountain. At this point, the state trooper shows up. And here's a 19-year-old girl in a bathrobe with two guys in a state in a car
now,
in state park.
Just to interrupt you real quickly, did he show up? Did someone tell him they saw something, or did he just happen to be driving?
I have no idea. Our sight was fixed on this glowing object, and all of a sudden there's a state trooper by our car. You know, what are you people doing? And I said, turn, you know, I tried to explain and not sound too crazy, and I said, turn around and look. And he turned around, and the mean expression suddenly white as a sheet, and he's like, get out of here, get out of here now. And so, you know, when a state trooper's scared, it's like, okay, maybe we should get out of here. So we took off. He passed us. He was hauling. He couldn't get out of there fast enough. And I would love if someday this story got to him and he got back to me. I'd love it clearly was something he had seen or experienced before and wanted no part of.
Really?
Again.
That's how you feel about it?
That's how because otherwise, if you just turn around and you see a pulsating light, you know, I don't know. Should it cause that much fear? He was terrified. He
wow.
was terrified. So it seemed that this was not his first run-in with something like that. So, yeah, that's my story. Now, red bathrobe and all.
Were there other witnesses that you're aware of? Or had anyone seen that at a different time? You know, did it come back?
I don't know if anyone else saw it that night, except my boyfriend remembers it. And he described it in the same, you know, my boyfriend from the time, we're still in touch, and he described it the same way. Lost touch with one of the other people, but I don't know who else had seen it that night. I spoke to someone who worked at the state park, and he doesn't remember that particular night, and he said, oh, I lived in the park. He said, we used to see things all the time.
Wow.
So, yeah. Real hot spot there.
Yeah, yeah. Hot spots have always baffled me how or why they are hot spots. You know?
I don't know. People, that's the number one question people say, you know, why the Hudson Valley? Why particular places like Pine Bush?
Yeah.
I don't know. I don't know if it's something that was here long before we were, something about the geology, the water. I just don't know.
Speaking about that phrase, something here a long time ago, I just want to say that next week, this is for the listener, next week we have Eric Von Daniken. He's going to be on. But you have to realize that the show is going to be at a different time. It's going to be at 11 a.m. Eastern Standard Time because he's in Sweden, and I have to accommodate the time for him. So just to let the listener
know.
Next week, Eric Von Daniken, but at 11 a.m. That should be a fun show. He's always a lot of fun to talk to.
Oh, that's amazing. So I'm kind of the warm-up act for Von Daniken.
Oh, no.
Hey, I'll take it. I'm honored.
That's really – I love to hear firsthand accounts of sightings, and that one's such a unique one. Were they – now, the thing I've heard is the opposite of that from a number of people that they've seen – well, Charles Holt, for one, that it burst into several lights. A friend of mine saw what looked like a square box that burst into five lights and then rotated around. You know, you hear about them coming apart but never joining as one. That's really bizarre.
Yeah, I have absolutely no explanation for it. I don't even know how that's possible. Right. It didn't look like three blobs stuck together. It looked like one round object. It had completely changed. So I'm very fortunate to have seen that. So I guess I was destined from a young age to do what I do.
Now, is that what actually sparked your interest into looking at all the different things you look at?
I was always very much into all the strange stories and, you know, the paranormal when I was a kid. It's nothing I thought I was going to do, but how I got into it was I was writing about local history for my county's bicentennial in the 1990s, and I was giving a series of lectures, and people were started asking about ghost stories, and I was kind of a little miffed. I'm like, I'm giving a history lecture, you know. But I was like, all right, I like ghost stories. So during one of my history lectures, I told the one ghost story I knew for my county. And the next day, this librarian calls. She goes, are you the ghost lady? I'm like, no, I hear you give ghost lectures. I'm like, where did you hear that? I told one ghost story. She goes, could you do a ghost lecture for us?
Oh, wow.
So I really, you know, you get, you know, a few dozen people for a history lecture. You get 200 for a ghost lecture. It's unbelievable. And word just spread. I, honest to God, Martin, I did not lift a finger to do this. People started sending me their house keys. I hear you're the ghost investigator. We're going on vacation. Can you come investigate my home while we're away? We think we have a ghost. I'm like,
wow.
What's just happened? I don't. So in rapid succession, I became the ghost lady. And I now, my first ghost book was 20 years ago already, 1998. I finally, after doing it for a while, I said, maybe I should come out with a book. There's so much interest in this. And now,
I'm sorry. Is it your science background the reason that people took you serious right off the bat, do you think?
I would like to think so. I was a research scientist for a medical diagnostics company, and I'm very much into the history, and I do my research, and I respect people's privacy. You know, I've never divulged anybody's identity or location, and perhaps they just saw I was going about it the right way, in a respectful way, and nobody was doing it back then. Within, I don't know, 8-10 years, everybody was getting a clever acronym and t-shirts, and they were suddenly all, you know, ghost hunters, and the shows started coming on.
Yeah.
But I had already established myself a long time ago, and they're just, you know, the who you're going to call, there was nobody to call in most places. Ghostbusters or Linda Zimmerman. I don't know how many times people have played that song for me enough already.
Oh, that's all right. Yeah.
So that's how it all, I had no intentions of writing about ghosts. I was just swept into it, and I went with it, and I was absolutely fascinated, and I was hooked for day one. The places I've been able to go into, you know, homes and museums and historic sites and experience things that nobody gets to do. It's nothing I'll ever stop doing, that's for sure.
Wow, that's great. And it's funny, we've talked about UFOs many times. I never knew this side of you. That's just fascinating.
I have many sides. In fact, I just last week finished my third zombie novel, so I do that too. But yeah, the UFOs actually came about because every time I'd give a ghost lecture, someone would come up to me afterwards and tell me their UFO story. And I'm like, why are you telling me this? And I'm like, well, you're the person to do this because they liked the way I handled the ghost cases. And they thought I was the one to hear their story and investigate it. So one weird thing, there we go. There's my territory.
Yeah.
One weird thing just led to the other.
Wow. So let's hear about some of the cases. Now, I have actually told my ghost story. I don't know what it was. Mm-hmm. So as a matter of fact, I wouldn't call it a ghost, but it was something that I actually experienced.
Yes, I heard that story, and I'd call it a ghost. I would call it something that was not happy you were cleaning out its house.
Yeah. Wow, you do remember that then.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. Now, and, you know, it's funny, just, I don't know, maybe 2 or 3 months ago, I was called by a friend of a relative that asked me to come over to their house. Their mother had recently passed away, and look at antiques. So I went over there, and it was right next door to that house. So I said to them, do you know the people next door?
Yeah,
I actually came out with it eventually while I was there because I ended up feeling comfortable enough and told them, mm-hmm. you know, basically the story. But I still want to go back to the house to see if the people are experiencing something.
Oh, I don't blame you. Did they know who that might have been? Was it a past owner, most likely?
You know, they don't know anything about it was a relative of theirs, but they didn't really know about the neighbor.
Yeah.
But still, yeah. It was bizarre. But let's hear about let's start out with your first investigation. What was that actually like?
My first investigation, I had no idea what I was doing. I had a camera. I had a cassette tape recorder. That's how far back I go. And it was the home of a famous local surgeon. She was an international humanitarian, had an AIDS charity to Africa. This beautiful mansion built in the style of a Scottish manor home from the 1300s. And I'm like, what am I doing going to this surgeon's home? But they had a ghost story. Soon after they moved in, she had her practice there. The maid saw a very tall man, long straight silver hair, who was looking at her very sternly and then just vanished. And they started hearing footsteps, doors opening and closing. And it wasn't threatening. They gave it a name, and they named the ghost, and they dealt with it. Then one day, an older woman comes to the door and says, you know, my father built this home. So the doctor said, you know, this may sound strange, but this is what we're seeing. You know, an extremely tall man with long silver hair. She doesn't miss a beat. That's my dad. Huh. He was 6'6", long white hair.
Wow.
And he built the home. And when he loved it so much, when he died, he was buried on the property. And his tombstone read, "From this place, I shall never roam."
Oh, my goodness.
So you can't. And this was my first case. This was my first case. And I went to the home, and I'll tell you, I'm upstairs in the corridor where they saw them. And I think I was shaking a little, and nothing happened. But, you know, it was an amazing, you know, again, a very high caliber group of witnesses, a famous surgeon and her staff of nurses. So I was, from a very early point in my ghost hunting career, able to dismiss that belief that it's, you know, people in overalls with a first grade education who see ghosts. That is not the case.
Right, right. And did you have like a strange feeling when you were in that? Not just your fear, but
mm-hmm.
like, did you have a feeling like, I mean, I think that's what a lot of people talk about.
There were a couple of times where I did a quick turnaround because I definitely felt like I was being watched, you know, when you think somebody's right behind you. So that was it, but it kind of got my spidey senses tingling. And after doing a couple of hundred cases now I'm not a psychic per se, but when you do something over and over again, now I'll walk into a location, I'm like, okay, you know, this is good, this is bad. You develop a sense for it. I've learned a lot. I had no idea what I was doing initially, but
well,
it worked
how could
out.
You? I mean, you know, you were in uncharted waters basically at the time. You know,
yeah.
Back then, I mean, they're using electronic equipment and things like that, and I don't know how much, you know, that really works.
Oh. I have some, but I think people get way too into, they have to run out and buy thousands of dollars of equipment. One woman did that, and on her first investigation, she realized she was too scared and hated it. And there she stuck with $2,000 in equipment.
Yeah.
But in a lot of these shows, they say, well, we discount personal experience. Like, what are you, crazy? No one has ever called me and said, oh, I woke up in the middle of the night because my EMF detector is going off. No, you call because you heard footsteps or a door slammed or you saw an apparition. You know, so it's very important to find out what people are experiencing. If you can get something on video or you can have a meter that will detect it, wonderful, but the real haunting is in the personal experience. And I decided very early on the best way for me to tell a ghost story is to try to experience that haunted activity, which is why the vast majority of the cases I write about, I've been there, done that.
Really? So I want to be talking about them. And so why don't we start with some of the cases that you investigated. And when you say you were right there when some things happened, is that what you're saying?
Oh, absolutely. Yes. Now, do you want to show some of the photos
I
sent?
Yeah, he's ready with any of those photos, sure. So
okay.
Any story you start talking about, we'll show the photos.
Well, if we want to start with the Lizzie Borden door. Lizzie Borden.
So you actually went to her place in Fall River. Fall River.
Yes.
Yeah.
It became a bed and breakfast only in America, right?
just for like the young people that don't know the story, they actually had Lizzie Borden took an axe and gave her mother 40 whacks, and when she saw what she had done, she gave her father 41. right? Is that how that goes? Something like
that's how the poem goes. That is not correct.
Not accurate.
No, her stepmother was hit in the back of the head with an axe 19 times, and her father was hit in the face 11 times with an axe. So these were very personal. This happened on August 4th, 1892 in Fall River, Massachusetts. The Bordens were very wealthy, but Mr. Borden was a bit of a Scrooge, and they lived in a very humble home with no plumbing, no electricity. And guess what? The stepmother was getting the father to change his will to make her the main beneficiary. And suddenly the two of them end up dead. And of course, it was kind of scandalous to think a woman could have done something like that. So she was put on trial. She paid an enormous amount of money for her legal team, and she was acquitted. And immediately she and her sister bought a huge mansion in the biggest part of town. But of course she was shunned the rest of her life.
That's
but
what I heard. Yeah.
Yes, but her house went through a series of private owners, and they experienced a lot of things, full-bodied apparitions, doors slamming, lights going on and off, you know, all the classic signs. So, again, the best way to experience a Lizzie Borden haunting is to go stay in the Lizzie Borden house. So back, I think it was 15 years ago, we went on the anniversary week of the crime. And long story short, we show up at check-in time. There's no staff. There's a bunch of guests sitting inside waiting, and the staff is missing. And there's a lot of antiques in this house. There's a bus station right across the street, not the best part of town. I was like, this isn't good.
All right, everyone. Thanks so much for listening. That's it for the free part of the show. If you'd like to support the show for $2 or more a month and get access to the full shows, all you have to do is go to podcastufo.com. And all that information's right there. The show does cost quite a bit to run, and it's actually good because we're getting a lot of downloads, hundreds of thousands. So anyway, we'll be back next week with Eric Von Daniken, and that should be a good show. And I want to thank some people that helped out with the show. First of all, Evan, for being the new producer. That helps a lot. Peggy, for managing the Facebook page. Alejandro Rojas, for the UFO updates, and of course, our guest, Linda Zimmerman. Thanks a lot, and remember to keep your eyes to the sky.